Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Searching for Franklin, New Answers to the Great Arctic Mystery by Ken McGugin. Narrated by Bob Sauer. Author's Note: Contemporary writers face special challenges when working with journals two centuries old. I have let stand idiosyncrasies of grammar and spelling while modernizing some usages, preferring Inuit to Eskimo, for example, and Dene to Northern Indians. After identifying William Ulibuck, Jr., I refer to him as Ulibuck. Where John Franklin and his men spoke of Augustus and Junius, I prefer Tatanuiuk and Hueyotaerok. And while Charles Francis Hall spoke of Hannah and Joe and wrote of them as Tukulito and Ebiarbing, I follow the modern phonetic consensus, Tukulituk and Epirvik. I keep trying to write an impeccable book, but if this one is flawless, devoid of inconsistencies, omissions, and gaffes, it will be the first. Fingers crossed. Prologue: The Myth of the Explorer. On day two of our Arctic voyage, we sail into a blizzard. It's 3:30 in the afternoon, and underwater archaeologist Marc-André Bernier is halfway through a presentation in the Nautilus Lounge on the search and discovery of Sir John Franklin's lost ships. Bernier is the expert running the investigation for Parks Canada. During the next couple of days, he proposes to lead a visit to the site of the Erebus, where many of us, as many as wish to, will go snorkeling over the site. Now, while outside the wind gusts above 50 knots, gale force, he talks about Parks Canada search operations over the past 8 years. The hunt for the ships dates back almost to 1845, when Franklin disappeared into the Arctic with the Erebus, the Terror, and 128 men. Now, Bernier reviews the unprecedented search, driven at first by the Royal Navy and the widowed Lady Franklin. He highlights the contributions of Inuit testimony as relayed through such explorers as Dr. John Ray, Charles Francis Hall, and Frederick Schwartke, who relied on interpreters William Ulibuck, Tukulituk, Tukulito, and Epirvik, Ibiarbing. Bernier explains that these accounts gave us an area but did not establish a location. That is why the Canadian search, which located Erebus in 2014 and the Terror 2 years later, required so much time and energy. Now, in September 2017, the storm rages unabated into late afternoon, and when Bernier finishes presenting, he hurries up onto the bridge to confer with the captain and Adventure Canada expedition leader Matthew James, M.J. Swan. None of them like it, but geography is having its way with history. Geography is manifesting as ice, heavy seas, and gale force winds, while history is bidding to extend the narrative of the Lost Franklin expedition by bringing adventure tourism to the wreck of the Erebus. To that end, we are sailing with a full complement, 197 passengers, 124 ship's crew, and 37 professional staff. These include Inuit culturalists, medical doctors, a marine biologist, an archaeologist, two professional photographers, an activist filmmaker, a seabird biologist, a botanist, a singer-songwriter, a team of videographers, two expert divers, and an author-historian, yours truly. At this point, I have been voyaging with Adventure Canada for 10 years, leading excursions and giving talks about exploration history. This time around, sailing out of the Northwest Passage, we expected to board the Ocean Endeavour on Canada's Arctic coast at the northwestern edge of Nunavut, more specifically in Kurilutuk at the mouth of the Coppermine River. Heavy ice cut short the preceding voyage, however, and so, with about 200 others, I flew 270 miles to Cambridge Bay and embarked there. The plan now is to sail through a narrow channel to anchor in Wilmot and Crampton Bay off the Adelaide Peninsula, roughly 300 miles away. In groups of 30, passengers will take a 40-minute Zodiac ride to an island near the Erebus site. There, in a collection of heated tents, we will meet underwater archaeologists and Inuit guardians and elders flown in from Joeyhaven on King William Island, the township nearest the site. I am especially excited to see Louis Kamukak, my old friend and fellow traveler. From the designated island, having relinquished any instruments that can record geographical coordinates, we will ride to the Erebus site in Zodiacs. There, while some people go snorkeling above the wreck, others will view the site from Zodiacs using viewing buckets, and still others will watch on screen as an ROV, remotely operated vehicle, visits the wreck. Maybe we will be present when divers surface with documents relating to Franklin's final expedition. Who can say? That's the plan. Geography insists on a different scenario. As the ship sails toward the channel, as narrow as half a kilometer, the wind blows 30 to 35 knots, gusting to 40, and the swell reaches 1.5 meters. Swan says later that if the wind had dropped to 15 or 20 knots, he stood ready to make an attempt. Instead, fog engulfs the entire region. At evening briefing, Bernier says he arranged for a twin otter to fly people in from Joa Haven, among them Louis Kamukak. But the pilot would need at least 1,000 feet of visibility, and that does not exist. At the Inuit Guardian's campsite, which comprises five tents, three of those tents have been blown off. Somebody asks, it might be me, what about lingering in the vicinity for a couple of days to wait out the storm? Speaking from experience, Bernier responds that these wind and wave conditions will have stirred up sediment so badly that at best the wreck will become visible in 3 days. And if the storm continues, we might have to wait a week. Bottom line, on this voyage, none of us will be snorkeling over the Erebus. I go out onto the top deck and stand in the wind as the Ocean Endeavour sails east along the southwest coast of King William Island toward Joa Haven. I can't help thinking about John Franklin's men, many of whom starved to death in the late 1840s as they struggled along this coastline. Later that evening, we anchor off Joa Haven, so named by Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen, who wintered here in the early 1900s while completing the passage in his tiny ship, the Joa. Come morning, there lies the town, population 1,350, snow-dusted and shining in the sun. By 8:30 a.m., passengers are piling into Zodiacs. On shore, having accomplished a wet landing in rubber boots, we split into half a dozen groups, say hello to local guides, and head out to explore the town. I go looking for Louis, but he is nowhere to be found. I do spot the Martin Bergman tied up to a dock. The previous year, guided by the local Inuk Sami Kogvik, searchers on that vessel had located Franklin's second ship, HMS Terror. Early afternoon, everyone gravitates to Kikirtok High School, a big modern building, for a cultural presentation. As I take a seat on one of the tiered benches overlooking the gym, finally I spot Louis in a crowd of standees. He catches my eye and gestures toward the main entrance, and we make our way into the hallway. After greeting each other, we fall to our usual kibitzing. By now, age 59, Louis is widely recognized as the leading Inuit historian of his generation. We commiserate about not getting to meet at the Erebus site. He mentions speaking recently with an elder, interviewing him, and I say, "Wait, aren't you an elder yet? When are you going to become an elder?" "I'm still too young," he says, grinning. "Way too young." Then he comes back at me. "When are you going to write your big Franklin book?" "My big Franklin book? You've written about everybody else. Don't you think it's time?" "No way," I shake my head. "I'm still too young." Together we laugh. 6 months later, Louis is dead. Research-based nonfiction is the most conservative of literary genres. If a particular work is also historical in nature, the conventions are especially tight and restrictive. In recent years, history-based narrative has relaxed enough to allow for a strong voice and personal presence. I have sought to establish both in writing five books about northern exploration. All five have highlighted the importance of the indigenous contribution to the Arctic enterprise. This sixth work does the same, but it differs from those previous books in structure and, in a small way, point of view. Over the past decade, while teaching in the MFA program in creative nonfiction at University of King's College, I have deliberated on how to structure a story. One presentation, which I have given to sundry writing groups, I call Adventures in Nonlinear Narrative. Harold Pinter, Doris Lessing, Quentin Tarantino, Martin Amis, Toni Morrison, Mordecai Richler, Günter Grass, Thomas King, Christopher Nolan, Lyndon McIntyre, all provide grist for the mill. where my previous Arctic books tell a single, roughly chronological story, Searching for Franklin interweaves two main storylines. In novels, plays, movies, biographies, or memoirs, such a structure raises no eyebrows, causes no alarm. In historical nonfiction, it flashes red. Whoa, what is going on here? Nor is that the only way this book challenges convention. I mentioned point of view. In the beginning, chapter 1, and at the end, epilogue, I directly address one of the figures in the book, my late friend Louis Kamukak. In addition, when writing from personal experience to channel immediacy, I use not the past but the present tense. Can historical narrative accommodate all this exuberance? I like to think so. Louis Kamukak asked after my Big Franklin book. In belated response, although it's just average in size, I offer Searching for Franklin, New Answers to the Great Arctic Mystery. To be clear, this is not a work about the countless expeditions that went hunting for the Franklin ships after they disappeared into the Arctic in 1845, a quest that, during the past quarter century, has inspired sundry novels, documentaries, and poems. Rather, here we go searching for the man behind the myth. To that end, this book takes what it needs from both the physical search and the life. My first encounter with the myth of Franklin came in 1998 when I spent 3 months on a fellowship at the University of Cambridge. One rainy night, with a floor lamp at my elbow and a mug of coffee in my hand, I sat reading a particularly cogent description of how Sir John Franklin had earned the right to be recognized as the discoverer of the Northwest Passage. The book was Frozen in Time. Co-authors John Geiger and Owen Beatty observed that the last survivors of the Franklin expedition had completed the passage only after a final doomed march from their ice-locked ships. They quoted the eminent naturalist Sir John Richardson, who had twice traveled with Franklin. They forged the last link with their lives. Even as I admired that line, I thought, well, so you're suggesting that while metaphorically they succeeded, in reality those men discovered nothing. They marched south along an ice-choked channel that would remain impassable for decades. And then they died, reporting nothing. Franklin himself had perished on June 11, 1847, months before a large party of men abandoned the ships. More to the point, the remnants of his ill-starred crew had struggled along a permanently frozen strait and died in a region where no passage existed. That night in Cambridge, I set aside the book, rose to my feet, and began pacing the floor. My newly acquired grasp of Arctic geography had enabled me to see what Richardson was hiding with his eloquence. John Franklin discovered nothing. This realization left me shaking my head. I had come face to face with the myth of Franklin as Arctic hero. Soon enough, I found clarification in The Myth of the Explorer. Author Bo Rifenberg argues that the creation of a powerful hero myth requires an exotic setting, a single-minded hero, the death of that figure, and mediators to celebrate him. Creating such a hero requires public relations experts, and already, at Cambridge, I was beginning to see that, in his formidable widow, the dead Franklin had one of the best. Flash forward 2 decades. Soon after I began writing this investigation, I realized that I would have to write a dual narrative, to interweave 2 stories. The first, which begins with Part 1, Searching for Franklin, is a framing tale that revolves around my 2-decades-long engagement with Arctic exploration. To create a complete experience, I have reworked a few incidents about which I have previously written, either in one of my books or in one of the 30 or 40 pieces I have published in newspapers, magazines, logbooks, and academic journals. While tracking my journey, complete with red herrings, wrong turns, and dead ends, this story encompasses key aspects of the physical hunt, the finding of graves on Beachy Island, the discovery of a written document at Victory Point, and the first reports of cannibalism, and it comprises several searches, Lady Franklin's for the 2 lost ships, Louis Kamukak's for the Franklin vault or burial site, and my own for the man behind the myth. Finally, it offers a new answer to the most famous of exploration mysteries, what happened to the 1845 expedition. In 1833, Captain John Ross and his men had emerged alive after surviving 4 winters trapped in the Arctic ice. What caused this later expedition to go so strangely and tragically wrong? The second narrative here, which opens with Part 2, The Royal Navy Man, treats Britain's first overland expedition, 1819 through 1822, in search of the Northwest Passage, a neglected story that excited me to write this book. It finds a young Lieutenant Franklin rejecting the advice and pleadings of an outstanding Dene leader, Acacho, and a peerless voyageur, the Dene French-Canadian Pierre Saint-Germain. An evangelical Christian who believed in miracles, John Franklin prays to the Lord while losing 11 of his 20 men to starvation, cannibalism, and murder. Yet in 1823, when he published his official narrative of this nightmare expedition, he became a celebrity. He became the man who ate his boots, a reference to how, in extremis, he and his men were driven to consuming their leather moccasins. Today, Franklin stands revealed as a classic exemplar of an age and its admonitions, both naval and religious, and might best be described as the Royal Navy man who couldn't listen. Part 1. Searching for Franklin. Chapter 1. A Vault on This Island. I see it all again, Louis. It's 2017, and as we stand laughing and joking in the front hall of Kikirtak High School, an announcer tells everyone to please take their seats. The show is about to begin. We agree to reconnect afterward, you and I, and rush back to our seats. We don't get to meet, though, because over the next half hour the wind grows fierce. We visitors have to cut short our stay and rush out into the howling afternoon. The Zodiac ride back to the ship, hanging onto a cord while pounding through 2-meter waves, shows doubters like me why we didn't get to the wreck of the Erebus. Because of the sudden rush, we never get to talk about polar bears. That's one of my big regrets, Louis, one of many. But forgive me, I neglected to say ublakut, good morning. That's how you greeted us each day when you came online. Ublakut, Louis, from a future you will never know. In September 2017, I never get the chance to talk with you about my polar bear theory. That too-short visit at the high school is the last time we meet face-to-face. Now I count on my fingers and see you had 6 months to live. During your final months, we do chat occasionally on the phone. I am helping polar adventurer David Reed organize an Arctic return expedition to the memorial plaque we erected to honor 19th-century explorer John Ray and his two travel companions. David is bent on replicating Ray's 1854 journey to the site from Repulse Bay, Nuyat. Yes, I was present at the conception, which happened on the Ocean Endeavor as we sailed into Ray Strait. When I tell you about this later, you make no secret of the fact that you are traveling regularly from Joahaven to Yellowknife and Edmonton, that you are in and out of hospital and receiving chemotherapy. But I happen to know you are not yet 60 years old. For some reason, I think you will be with us for many years yet. How stupid is that? In my defense, Louis, I have to say you did encourage me to believe that you would survive indefinitely. At one point you raised a subject we had discussed as early as 2013, the idea of me helping you write an autobiography. I said I'd be delighted. That, in fact, we must do it. Not only that, but in January 2018, you agreed to become the Joahaven consultant to the Arctic Return Expedition, which is slated to set out in the spring of 2019. I am going to fly to Joahaven. Together, you and I and a few young hunters will travel by snowmobile to greet David Reed's overland expedition at its culminating point, the memorial plaque we installed in August 1999. We would celebrate our 20th anniversary at the site. 2 months later, Louis, you went and died. For me, that drains the Arctic Return Project of energy. I no longer want to go and meet the overlanders. I let slide that part of the plan. In spring 2019, David Reed does lead a 3-person excursion, retracing the original route. So that ends well. But now, as I write, I find myself spinning off into our own expedition. From Calgary, via Edmonton and Yellowknife, I fly north to Joahaven. I travel with your old friend Cameron Trelevin, that adventurous antiquarian book dealer with whom you have already done some Arctic rambling. You meet us at the airstrip, 39 years old, full of laughter and energy. But now I think of those reading over my shoulder, people who never met you. Shall I catch them up, tell them that you emerged into the world on August 26, 1959, Louis-Irinik Kamukak, at a seal hunting camp on Boothia Peninsula near Talayuak, formerly Spence Bay? You were the second oldest child born to Mary Kamukak and her hunter husband, George. Now, in 1999, you head a family of six, supervise the maintenance of community housing, and find yourself immersed in two historical projects, one involving Inuit place names, the other traditional oral stories. Above all, as emerges quickly enough, you are obsessed with finding the Franklin Vault, the grave in which you believe the celebrated explorer lies buried. In 1999, most strangers to Joe Haven stay at the barn-like Amundsen Hotel, where a shared room costs more than $200 per person per night, the equivalent today of roughly $330. Thanks to you, Cameron and I will spend four nights in Joe Haven in a one-room cabin you built 3 or 4 miles out of town. One evening, you take us by motorboat to the Todd Islets, 15 miles west of Joa. You show us the Franklin site your grandfather, William Paddy Gibson, discovered in the 1930s, a scattering of white bones on the ground, with a few larger ones protruding from beneath the earth. These remains lay along a known route of the Franklin retreat. I find them interesting, but I am no forensic archaeologist, and to me they can reveal nothing new. You note proudly that Gibson, your Irish grandfather on your mother's side, was a district inspector for the Hudson's Bay Company. At this site in 1945, still searching, he found and reburied a complete human skeleton, plus skulls and bones belonging to Franklin's men. He published his findings in the Geographical Journal and the Beaver magazine. Two generations later, as his grandson, already you are more involved in the Franklin search than any other living Inuk. You tell me, I believe Franklin is lying in a vault on this island. For years you have been hunting that burial site. Your obsessive search is rooted in a yarn you heard from Humahuk, your great-grandmother, as a boy. When she was very young, 6 or 7, she was traveling with her family along the northwestern coast of King William Island, looking for driftwood. The party spotted a ridge, went to investigate, and came across artifacts they hadn't seen before, spoons and forks and other utensils, even musket balls. Humahuk said she also saw a long rope or chain trailing into the water, and nearby, a strange stone slab. Her stories always stayed in my head, you told me. You used to say, one of these days I'm going to find that spot. When you were 12 or 13, one of your teachers talked about Franklin's men dying as they walked along the west coast of King William Island. That's when you put the two together, the history of the lost expedition and the story your great-grandmother told. To you, Humahuk's description of a stone slab suggested the cover of a burial vault. As an adult, you are bent on finding that site and returning Franklin's body to England to rest beside that of his wife. And the vault? The vault will be a tourist benefit for the community and for students to go see. You never did find the Franklin Vault, Louis, but you did become an honorary vice president of the Royal Canadian Geographical Society. You received the Erebus Medal, the Lawrence J. Burpee Medal, the Canadian Governor General's Polar Medal, the Order of Canada, the Order of Nunavut. So, no small recognition, all thanks to your successes in interpreting between cultures and arriving at a comprehensive understanding by comparing Inuit stories and the narratives of the Kalunat, or white men. Down through the years, encouraged by your wife Josephine, you interviewed, informally, dozens of local people and sifted through their stories. The oral tradition tells a lot of history, you told me once, but it isn't always easy to interpret. Somehow, you managed. Even so, the Louis Kamukak I most like to remember is the one who, in 1999, introduced me to the High Arctic. I see you now, Louis. Two nights after visiting the Todd Islets, and immediately after supper, we all three climb into your 20-foot boat and roar north up the east coast of King William Island. We make a brief stop below a high plateau that your people, the Netsilingmiut or Netsilik Inuit, call Avak. We hike to the top of this ridge and take in this spectacular view over Ray Strait, nothing but water as far as the eye can see. Around 9:45 p.m. we regain the boat, and while a stiff north wind surrounds us with white caps and spray billows over the canopy of the boat, thump 14 miles across Ray Strait. In the pounding, exhilarating ride, much rougher than along the coast, I realize, "Whoa, Louis, shouldn't we be wearing life jackets?" How you laugh, Louis. You jerk your thumb at three orange life jackets jammed behind my seat. "Put one on if you like," you say. "Out here, you go into the water, a life jacket will only make things worse. Too cold. You won't survive 10 minutes. I don't doubt it, but I do don one of those life jackets. And that is the kind of memory I've been reliving, Louis, ever since, at your behest, I turned my attention to John Franklin himself. You were the one, Louis, who brought me to him. The Inuk brings the Kalunat to the English naval officer, surely one of life's little ironies. When we met, as you know, I was obsessed not with Franklin but with Dr. John Ray, an explorer who listened to the indigenous peoples. About the Royal Navy officer, I cared not a whit, except as he impacted the story of John Ray, who trained in Edinburgh as a medical doctor before entering the fur trade with the Hudson's Bay Company. But in 1999, as we ramble around the Arctic tundra, you keep bringing me back to the good Sir John. You insist that searchers will find his body in a vault on King William Island. One group of Inuit, you tell me, witnessed the burial of a great chief under the ground, under a flat stone. Traditionally, the Inuit wrap their dead in caribou skins, place them on the surface of the ground, and build cairns over them. In this case, the hunters investigated the site, but all they found was a flat stone. They said the dead man was a great shaman who turned to stone. Another group of hunters chanced upon a large wooden structure. They took a piece to use as a crosspiece for a sled. The man who told this story said there was a large flat stone, and he could tell the stone was hollow. You never did stop searching for Franklin's vault. As late as the spring of 2016, you mounted an all-terrain vehicle expedition and led two young hunters in setting out across the island toward its northwest coast. Heavy rain and mud caused you to run low on gas. Progress impossible, you had to turn back. Never mind. Now, in what for me is that magical, ever-present August, we reach the west coast of Boothia Peninsula at 20 minutes past midnight. With daylight dwindling to dusk, we guide the motorboat carefully through the shallows into a nondescript bay. To me, it looks indistinguishable from every other indentation. But you say you know it, and that is good enough for me. 50 yards from shore, your 20-foot boat runs aground in the shallow water, and we three adventurers pull on rubber boots, clamber over the side, and drag the craft farther onto the reef before burying two anchors in the sand. Around 1:30, as dusk yields to twilight, we finish lugging our equipment and supplies on shore and, on the rocky, treeless ground, pitch a floorless, handmade canvas tent, securing it with stones. Knowing the sun will rise above the horizon in just 2 hours, we unroll our sleeping bags and crawl into them, hoping to fall asleep quickly. At my urging, we have come to this desolate spot to honor Ray and the only two men who could keep up with him, the Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, Thomas Mistigan, and the Inuk, William Ulibuck. From Calgary, Cameron and I have brought a plaque of weather-resistant anodized aluminum screwed to a slab of Honduran mahogany. In Joy Haven, you took us to a workshop and welded the plaque to a heavy metal stand. We are good to go. Our late 20th century campsite sits by the strait through which Roald Amundsen sailed in 1903 through 1906 as the first explorer to navigate the Northwest Passage. And half a century before that, when John Ray realized that this strait was almost certainly the missing link in the passage between North and South Channels, he built a stone cairn. Our objective was to find this cairn and, during this last summer of the 20th century, and indeed the millennium, erect a plaque where he and his two fellow travelers fit the final piece into a centuries-old geographical puzzle. Fortunately, Ray not only described the place where he created the marker, but also noted its geographic coordinates. After breakfast, we set out. Remember, Louis? After rambling around inland for a few hours and finding nothing at Ray's specified longitude, we cross a waterway and follow the coast north. Finally, at around 4:30 p.m., we again approach Ray's latitude, only now...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?